Good morning, everyone. We were studying Ecclesiastes, and we stopped on page 5 of chapter 1. We were just, we recovered, the author of the book and the theme and the purpose. And we were going through seeing illustrations of vanity in everyday life, the never-ending cycles we see in the nature and in our labor. And we stopped on, we were looking at verses 8 and 9 of chapter 1. We were talking about the all things are full of labor, and kind of what we thought that meant, or what I thought that meant. It applied to not just what we consider everyday work, the stuff we don't want to do, but it applies to all our activities, both the ones we do enjoy and the ones we don't enjoy. So all our life is full of labor, and we were getting to the question there, what does it mean the eye and the ear are not satisfied or filled, which is in the end of verse 8. All things are full of labor, man cannot express it, cannot utter it, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. And I think we actually started discussing it a little before we got to here, but what do we all think it meant?
It means you always want more. You're never satisfied.
So it's like a man's desire is not fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have any other thoughts? That's very possible. It's a tricky one. Does anyone agree with David? Or does anyone have their own unique thoughts? Well, I think it very well could mean what David says, in regards to man's desires is it's never satisfied. But when I read it, to me, it seemed to say something different, and I thought it meant our labor is not ceasing. Where we looked right before this part and. Verse 8 says, all things are full of labor. We see the eye is not satisfied with seeing or the ear filled with hearing. And right after in verse 9 it says, and that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And so it's another idea of, the labor of man, those things we do, we've done in the past, and they will be done again by others in the future. So it's all surrounded by labor. And I think what really makes it stand out to me that is the ear filled with hearing. A lot of people, we see other scriptures in the Bible where it's talking about man's desire, his eye, his lust and his thirst to satisfy with his eye. But the ear is filled with hearing, to me, seems like, there's a labor you're working when you're laboring. Usually you're laboring to complete something. And this idea of the ear will be filled up, like it's made, it's completed. To me, it seems like labor with surrounding with the other verses. And in the eye, of course, the same thing that, except I think it's that satisfied which makes us think of desire. If I don't know how you would say the eye is anything but satisfied. If your eye was filled up with seeing, would we think the same thing as, satisfaction, desire? And with the context of all labor in front of it and behind it, to me, it makes it seem like it's about, our labor does not cease. We've seen verse 4 through 7, where we see the sun and his labor, the generations come and go, the wind does not cease to labor, the cycle of, I never did look up the word, the water, evaporates from the ocean and turns to, condensates and falls and then flows down back to the ocean and back and forth. It's all this labor that's continuing. And there's no, idea of satisfying, of course it's not with regard to man, but it's just this labor that's continuing to go and go and go. There's no end to it. There's no ceasing it, and there's no result that would, stop.
Michael, it's kind of like productivity. Over the years, there was a time in this country that a lot of wives did not work. That one wage earner was enough to support a family. And nowadays, you look at the most do work. But we've had productivity gains over the years that were unparalleled. I can remember even when my short career with the post office, you know, that one time when someone would type a report and they made a mistake, they had to start over. And nowadays you backspace a couple of spaces and then you keep on going. You don't have to, all these productivity gains, but all of us are even busier than we were before. Have we really gained anything from all this
technology advances?
Yeah.
We're getting work done faster than we ever have in the past, and still we have more work to do.
That's
my view on it. That's kind of how I take it. I can see how you could look and say, yeah, man does desire, man continues to work. I could see that, but in the context, I feel it's different. You could also mean, I read somewhere that, we're discussing the whole purpose of our book is looking for that which profits man. And so I read that it was taken as someone's interpretation was that man continues to look and to listen for that thing which will give us profit under the sun. That, we have this desire to fill that need to what is profitable to us. Maybe that's what, so it sort of falls in with desire, but it's different. It's not a desire to, or I guess a fleshly desire, but it's this idea of what is profitable. I don't know. I can't say specifically one way or the other. I just think it's the never-ending acts of labor. And that's the eye, as long as it's functioning, will never cease. You'll never cease to use it to continue in labor, and your ear will always work. It's never filled up. It doesn't stop. You're always going to use it as long as you have it. And, there's the idea of any activity is labor. That's an activity that's just ongoing. It's not really critical which way, one way or the other. Yeah, but it is just the idea of labor. Our labor does not cease. And we're never gonna stop in our efforts of laboring. And move on into verse 9. We see there's that which has been is what will be, that which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Verse 10, is there anything of which may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. So is there really nothing new under the sun? How do you interpret that?
It's a constant cycle. Like you said about the water cycle, but it's just going to keep repeating itself.
Yeah. What do you think this new thing is there? What is the... If he's saying there really is nothing new, so what is he trying to wrap up there?
Labor.
Sorry. Yes, there's nothing new. There's no new labor. We're continuing to labor. I guess it'd be the idea of labor in itself is not new. We always develop new things, new ways to labor, don't we? And it's... it's not the matter of there's not new knowledge, is there? Or there's not new, forms of enjoyment or new, advancements made, like we were talking about advancements, like the computers, to us, brand new. No one's ever had it before. So certainly he's not talking about new objects in life. Of course, we don't have any new animals. God made those ones, so we don't need anything new there. But that I don't think that any of that's what's in discussion here. We know in verse 16 of this same chapter, it says, I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. And so we know this isn't, this nothing new. It isn't talking about knowledge. For the preacher himself, Solomon, gained more knowledge than all who were before him. He achieved something new. He has new information. So it's not talking about knowledge. And we know, we also see the parallel passage in 1 Kings chapter 3. Verse 12 through 13. When God is speaking to Solomon. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I have given you what you have also asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings of all your days. And so he is on new ground. He has new knowledge that no one's ever had and no one ever will. He had riches beyond anyone's ever seen before at that time. He's made new records. So it certainly doesn't apply to this nothing new. It doesn't apply to those things. And of course, we mentioned the computer, the nuclear age, the ability to harness the atom for energy and destruction. And of course, space travel. It's all new things.
On verse 9, do you think he's talking about maybe evil and righteousness of man? Because he brings it up later on in the book, but I was just wondering if he's not preluding to it. You know, that which is done will be done. You know, talking about labor, but also just the ways of man, the evilness and the righteousness of it.
I think that's exactly what he's talking about. Because people talk about something horrendous happens and say, this has never been done. If you go back to the Bible, some of the evil that was done in the Bible was like what Absalom and David's other son that raped his daughter. And all the evil that was on the earth at the time of Noah was so bad, God was going to wipe everybody off the earth. Yeah. So I think that's a big part of what he's talking about. Man's imagination for evil is no worse than it's ever been. It's always bad. It's always been bad.
Yeah, I mean that's just another labor of man. I don't see here where he's specifying on evil as a specific, but just as general, anything man has done, including evil, including good, whatever, he's done it before, he's going to do it again. Nothing's changed. He's not getting any worse, he's not getting any better. I don't think it's specific to evil here. I mean, it's just, there's nothing that shows specific to evil. But so it's just man's activities, they're the same.
So you think it's man's activities, experiences on the earth?
Yes.
Is that different from labor?
I think that is labor. Where I think when we define labor as any physical or mental effort, that...
So that's what you meant a while ago by, in the context that he's talking about labor before and after the eye and the ear thing?
Yes. Okay. That's what I mean. He's talking about labor, that labor before is any activity, anything we do or any thought, any effort we apply is labor. I didn't want to isolate. A lot of times when people think of work, they think of the 8 hours a day I put in at my job is work. After that, I don't do work. Or you know, no one says that. But I mean, you know, when I'm free time, oh, it's not work, that's fun. But that's still an activity, that's still what here he's saying as labor, as he defines it here. You know, King Solomon didn't have to work at all. He could have gone around having fun all his days, but that's still, as he defines it, I think, a form of labor. It's his activity. And so it's something he's doing. He's physically expending effort or mentally. And so that's his labor. You know, in this context and under the sun. Does anyone have any other thoughts on that? We can come back to it. Rocky or...
When we think about things, or what's new, I mean, there's a lot of new things in the world, right? We've got accumulated knowledge, mm-hmm. new cities, new governments, and everything. There's a lot of new stuff all around us. It continues to be as time progresses. But I think when we started this class, you keep making the point, and I think we always have to keep coming back to this, is that any time we do any interpretation in the book of Ecclesiastes, we've got to remember, you know, the context and the viewpoint. And I think this is a case in point where we need to apply that. And I think really you got to tie verse 10 back to verses 2 and 3. And the point is, I think he's trying to make here, you know, first of all, we start out in verses 3 through 7 about observations of life, how things continue on and on, and now he gets into this labor thing. And I think what he's saying is that there is nothing new under the sun, anything new, that changes his answer to this question. Is there anything new that changes that man's going to be able to profit in all his work on the sun? Yeah. No, it's not. There's nothing new in that sense. And so, you know, a lot of these things I think we got to keep coming back to, you know, verses 2 and 3.
Yeah.
There's nothing new that's going to change this equation that there's a vanity of life and you look at your viewpoint of looking at man's lifetime here on earth and with the sun. It doesn't change. It's still the same thing.
Yeah, is my next point was, you know, when we look at all these new things that we made, how we say nothing's new, we look at these new things that are indeed new, you know, do these achievements satisfy or answer the question posed in verse 3? Are they profitable to us? Have we gained something that actually brings us profit in our lives under the sun?
Yeah.
No, not really.
In 12:8, at the end of the book, he says they're all his vanity. After he's written about all of these things, he still says it's all vanity.
It's the beginning of the book, verse 2, all is vanity. And at the end of the book, all is still vanity. After he completes all this analysis, we know that these things aren't profitable. Whatever, you know, they are, maybe we're better with them than without them, but it doesn't make our lives under the sun profitable. Whatever we gain, we lose when we pass away. You know, if we gain any happiness, as we said, as we talked about before, happiness is so fleeting. You know, you have it for a moment, and then it's something occurs and it's gone. And none of these things are profitable to us. There's nothing new which has been found that has given us new profit, you know, new advantage. And we continue to read on in verse 11.
Hey, Michael,
yes.
I just want to make a comment about the idea of labor. Well, since they brought it up, one thing we can keep in mind also, because this idea of labor or work or whatever, if we go to chapter 3 at the end of it, or not really the end of it, but in verse 9, you see this idea. It says, what profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? And I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. So it's an idea of basically just what we do or how we spend our time.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, because before that, it goes into this time. Yeah. So just something to think about in that
same way. Yeah, you see the same thing as what we spend our time on is our activities we engage in, that is our labor.
Right.
But what do we profit from?
Yeah.
We don't. Or, you know, like I said before, it's a matter of we may profit something, but it's fleeting and it's temporary.
It's talking end result.
Yeah, so we're talking the end result of our lives.
Right. Yeah, I just want to emphasize the point you just made is that you can look at any point in your life. There's a lot of things profitable. I mean, I go to a job, I get earned money, I pay bills, retire. There's a lot of profit when you look at it, you know, in a short time frame. But when I look at it over, and I think that's getting the viewpoint, over the entire lifetime, beginning and end, there's not.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's also another perspective, is that it's talking about, you know, the whole lifetime from beginning to end, because there's a lot of profit on individual things for a short period of time, but in the end,
that brings to mind the same thing I said Wednesday night, where by working, you know, I make food to provide my family, keep it alive. To me, that's profitable, sustaining our lives. But in the end, it's an objective that can't be maintained. Eventually, we will die, and you will fail at that task. And so, you know, you went through all that work only to not succeed. Well, you know, I find it profitable to keep on going for a while, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's all vanity. And so I was looking to verse 11. You saw there's nothing new. It's already been in times ancient times before us. Verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. And so we're not talking about knowledge that is gained or lost, but I think in a matter of, you know, people's individual achievements, which, you know, in the individual man, what you do, it's been the same thing that's been done before. Just like that person doesn't remember the people before him, no one's going to remember us long after. And I don't have too much else to say on that.
It may not be applicable, but, you know, I think that verse, I think kids and the kids, children and parents, the relationship. How many times have we told our kids, you know, don't do that? And of course, they repeat the same mistakes that we repeated that our parents told us not to do. Things that they told us not to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on this, in this section? We're looking at vanity illustrated in life. If not, we'll move into the author's quest for the answer. Of course, this whole book. Yeah, go ahead, David.
That's good. Oh, I guess I'll just wait until you touch on verse 13.
Okay.
I just can't wait.
Are you jumping ahead?
Yeah.
All right. So, the whole book is, you know, Solomon seeking to answer this question. And here he lists out his quest, beginning in verse 12 and 13. I sort of already answered. In 12 and 13, what did the preacher aim to do, specifically in verse 13? How does he word it there?
Set his heart to seek and search out about wisdom.
Yes, mm-hmm. All that is done under the sun. So he set his heart to seek and search wisdom. And before we move into that, I just wanted to start by defining wisdom and this word, this term, seek and search. Wisdom, there's depending on how you use it in the context, there's different forms of wisdom. Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines wisdom as the accumulated philosophic or scientific learning, just general knowledge of this earth. And then, two is another style, is the ability to discern inner qualities and relationships. And so, when he's using wisdom here to understand, you know, to try to answer this question, he's not using just a standard wisdom of, I've read a lot of books and I know a lot of things. Specifically, you know, I know knowledge about, and you know, we're seeing 1 Kings, Solomon knew about all the trees and all the animals, and he could discuss and talk to everyone about those, and they're all amazed at his knowledge. Is that knowledge that applied to this same wisdom to help him understand the question? That knowledge I wouldn't think would help. But his ability to discern, you know, inner qualities and relationships of things, you master logical reasoning. And I think that's what he's applying here, this wisdom, applying to his task to help him understand what is profitable for man. And we look at seek and search. Those two things can be used, they can be synonyms to using the same thing. If I lost something, I'm going to go seek for it. I'm going to go search for that which I lost. So why does he use these words, the same word, you know, back to back? I think because they can imply a different meaning. And when I look to the dictionary, the way we use it, first search I have, search one, is to superscript one. To examine and seeking something. To look through or explore by inspecting possible places of concealment and investigating suspicious circumstances. And so here you're seeking for something, you're looking, exploring where something might be concealed. It gives that idea of something that you don't have right now. It's out there, and you're going to go find it. And so I think that applies to seek. He's going to seek out that which he does not have, which would be knowledge and more understanding of the surrounding world. And the search superscript two is to look or inquire carefully, to make painstaking investigation or examination. And so this would be, I think, a different type of searching. And we both use these different types of search all the time. But this one is more the idea of something you have in your hand, and now you're going to examine it carefully. You're going to get the microscope, or say, you know, whatever. You're going to look through it. Say someone gave you a chest, and you're going to search through it. You already have it. You're not searching for it. Now you're going to search through it, and you're going to analyze it. And so to me, these two together can bring together more thoughts, more deeper meaning of what he's going to try to do. He's going to go out to the world. He's going to observe. He's going to gather information. He's going to bring that together. He's going to get more together than anyone's done before, and then he's going to analyze what he's found or what he's got, this information, and search through that information for the answer. And in wording it that way, it brings to mind stuff I do at work, being an engineer. We're first given an issue. I hope that no one gets too bored. But it helps me understand. It might not help you understand. But when we have an issue, someone's like, this is broken. Fix it. You know, the first thing we do is we don't know anything about it. So we start information, data gathering. Like I said, information gathering. You question the person who gave it to you. What's it doing? What are the symptoms of the failure? How did it occur? And then you start doing some probing and so forth, gathering as much information, maybe performing some tests and seeing the outcome of those tests. But this whole time, you're trying to seek for the answer, but you're just gathering information. When you have the information, is the problem solved? Usually not. We just have a bunch of information and a bunch of clues. Then we change modes. We go from data gathering to data analysis. This is something we do every day. Now we have all the data. We've been, you know, doing these tests performing. Now we dive into it and try to figure out the links between them that possibly would have caused this failure. And so there's these two different modes of searching for the information and then searching through the information. I don't know if that was helpful to you or not, but in my mind, since that's a day-to-day activity, I like presenting it that way. I don't know if there's any other engineers in here, though. Mr. Ottersbach left me alone.
Well, I'm not an engineer, but the medical field is fair. We have the same type of scenario. Patient comes into clinic, they have this symptom, this symptom, this symptom. Then they go in and take their tests, and you correlate the symptomology with the results of the tests, and then you may have to go and do a little bit more invasive, like a CT or something, to find out exactly what the deal is. And you put all this information together to come up with a diagnosis.
That's correct. And, of course, there's not always, like she sort of mentioned, there's not always a defined, I'm done with the data gathering, now I'm going to do the analysis. Sometimes you get an analysis and you're, I need to do another test, so you go back and forth. But, yeah, I see that something. David?
Both of y'all, it just makes me think of the scientific method, like different parts of it for both of them. So that's kind of what I see Solomon is. It's like, okay, I've got my process, now I'm going to go evaluate everything.
The logical reasoning he applied to the task.
And the one thing that is in common with all of these things, it takes the human element. The computer can't do it all.
Yeah.
It takes the human element to come to a conclusion. The computer can give you this, 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 and this, but you've got to put the clues together to come up with an answer.
That's correct. And of course, we know Solomon didn't have a computer. He had to do it the hard way. I also wanted to go to Proverbs chapter 2. It's just a see what was done. Proverbs 2 through 4. This is, of course, Solomon's writing. It says, "So that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you understand the fear of the Lord." And so that's the same idea of searching and seeking. I have some other scriptures here we're going to go to, but you know, when we've analyzed it the way we just have, do you think Solomon, this task, he just went about it, you know, flippantly? Was this just a brief little study, a weekend project? Or is this something that he went, you know, he investigated very comprehensively, very thoroughly, something that probably took a great amount of time? I think that's what he has done. We see the same thing that in Proverbs 2, to apply your heart to understanding, to, you know, you're crying out for understanding. Also in 1 Timothy chapter 4. First Timothy 4, verse 15. I mean, this is a commandment to us as Christians. It says, verse 15, "Meditate on these things, give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all." So here's talking about, you know, meditating and study, and you know, so it's a different idea than just, you know, as he's saying, just read it and, you know, do it. He's saying meditate on it. It's reading it, it's studying on it, and it's dwelling on it, and then applying it in your lives. And that's, you know, it's a different context for what they're talking about, but it's the same idea of this intent focus.
That person reads, "Take pains with these things and be absorbed in them." Those two different words might help us understand it also.
Yeah, it's you know, this isn't a simple task, is it? Taking pain to understand. So it's, you know, this is in-depth study that Solomon is doing. We also see that through Ecclesiastes. In verse 16, it talks about, you know, in his search, he says, "I communed with my heart," saying, look, so he's communing with his heart. Verse 17, "I set my heart to know wisdom." In verse 1 of chapter 2, "I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with mirth." Verse 3, "I searched in my heart." Verse 12 of chapter 2 says, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom." verse 1 of chapter 4, then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. Verse 4 of that same chapter, again I saw that for all toil and every skillful work a man is envied. So he keeps, I think I'll say one more sentence, 7, then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. So he's going and he continually comes back to this, you know, focus of trying to understand. You know, he's considering it internally, you know. It says, I turn myself to consider wisdom. So he keeps returning to considering. He's really applying himself, you know, and over periods of time. So he's really seeking the answer. And more devoutly than, you know, we suppose more devoutly than anyone's done before. We know he had more wisdom than anyone before. Why? Well, man, I hate when I start answering my own questions. Why was he so qualified to perform this task? That we can trust his conclusions.
His wisdom was God-given.
Mm-hmm. His wisdom was God-given. We see that in 16, we see the preacher had more knowledge and more wisdom than all who were before him. We look back to 1 Kings 3:12. We just read that previously, where God asked him to dream and gave him wisdom. He gave him not just that his wisdom was given by God. I mean, God can give others wisdom, but he gave Solomon more than anyone else. In 1 Kings 3:12, he said exactly that. I've given you more than anyone before you and anyone who will come after you. So therefore, he's got to be the most knowledgeable man that's ever been on this earth, except for Jesus, who is in fact God. So wisdom, that sets him apart from us. I want to also read 1 Kings 4. Oh yeah, I remember what it is. So in 1 Kings 4:29, it says, and God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all men. So he was the wisest of men. And this, I think, is the most important qualifier to wisdom. And it's the only, we have a few more factors we're going to look at, but these other factors only facilitate the wise man. If you have these other factors without the wisdom, they would be useless. So wisdom is the most important thing that he has, and he has it in greater extent than any of us. In verse 12, Ecclesiastes 1, and also in 1 Kings 4, what did we find was the another factor there that so qualified him? He was king over Israel. And in 1 Kings 4:21, I'll keep my finger over there. He was king over Israel, and more than that, I want to show that in verse 21 of chapter 4 of 1 Kings, it says, so Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. And in verse 24, for he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tipsah even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side all around him. So he was a king in his region, but he had such power and authority that he exercised that. He had subjection over other kingdoms, over other kings who were subject to him. And that's really what I want to point out, is not just him being, well, yeah, he is the king, but being the king, he has power. He has authority to exercise his will, to do as he wants. You know, if a wise man, you can be wise, but if you haven't the power to exercise what you want, you're subject to someone else, you may not be able to apply your task to understanding what profit has a man under the sun. Your king or whoever you're subject to would take you and apply you to the tasks he wants performed. And so here, he is the most wise. He is the king, so he can do as he sees fit. He can, you know, focus himself on this. And then in Ecclesiastes 2, verses 7 through 8, and also in 1 Kings 3, what factors here aid him in his search, make him so qualified?
A lot of experience and wealth.
Yeah, a lot of wealth, right? I mean,
there was no restrictions to what he could do as because he didn't have the money to do it.
Exactly.
He had unlimited funds and unlimited resources.
Yeah, in 1 Kings 3:13, where God's talking to him and he asks for wisdom. In 13, God says, "And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days." And also in chapter 10. Yeah, chapter 10. That's long. I just pointed that to you so you could read it. But that goes through all his wealth and showing how all the different kingdoms and the different people from foreign lands were bringing wealth to him, and his wealth was accumulated. He had great, great wealth.
Whatever his eyes desired, he got.
Yeah.
So whatever he looked at, he could have.
So there was no obstacles to... he's going to set himself to this search. You know, yeah, I could say that. I'm going to set myself to this search. Well, after my 8 hours of work, and you know, and after I take care of the kids, and well, I really don't have much time to dedicate to it anyway. He has, you know, great wisdom. He has a power and authority, and he has wealth. You know, if a man was wise yet didn't have wealth, he's going to be restricted in what he can do, right? I mean, he's going to have to seek to apply his wisdom to provide for his family, and so that limits, you know, the person's ability to focus on the subject. And of course, like, even if you have power, without wealth, I mean, not all kings are rich. But you're a king in a poor kingdom. You don't have a great amount of wealth to exercise to do what you want. But with these three together, wisdom, with his power, with his wealth, you know, what obstacles or deficiencies would limit him from his search, from dedicating a more thorough search than anyone who's ever done before?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the shortness of life is one of them.
Time and God.
But, sorry?
Time and God.
Yeah, time and God. But compared with other men, what we mean, we're all limited by that factor.
I guess we have so much time. Another person's perspective, you know, a poor person, I mean, he wouldn't be able to.
So you're talking about point of view?
Yes, he wouldn't be able to have a poor person's
Yeah, but I agree with you. He doesn't have a poor person's point of view, but I think that could be overcome with objective analysis. And we know that he was the wisest man on earth. When you're talking about a limitation of point of view, that means that person's not being objective. They're, of course, we're all living within our own lives, but the inability to step out and see from around him that point of view, I think he overcomes that with wisdom. I think his objective analysis in reasoning would. He would overcome that hurdle, I believe. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think he would. I know, you know, they say, you know, look at other people's point of views, you know, see from their shoes. It's not something that is something that can limit you, but I think you can. Anyone nowadays can, in fact, overcome that limitation without being, like, say, you know, poverty stricken. You know, if you have some wisdom, some knowledge, and you can look at and think about, you can get where that person is coming from. I don't think he would have been limited by that. With the God-given knowledge he had, I think he would have been all right, but maybe a mistake. Someone?
I think also that his experiences, I mean, he had a lot of slaves, knew about their lives. I mean, all through there, he always talks about everything under the sun. In verse chapter 4, verse 1, he looked at all the acts of oppression. You know, so he's I think he's being very objective. He's seeing the full picture.
Yeah.
Both the rich and the poor and the good and the evil, and trying to put all into an equation to figure out if there's any problem.
That's a good fact, Sever. Not blowing it away, but I think he could overcome it. Did anyone else have any other thoughts? Anything that we think might restrict him?
Somebody mentioned death. I was thinking, like, just he was seeking after wisdom and he was looking after madness and folly, and he thought this was driving after the wind, too. So you have your own limitations. You can't just, there's not an end to wisdom with mankind. You're not going to be able to discover everything. His conclusion was the same, but
correct.
There was still more that to be discovered.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't know everything in the world. You know, only God knows all. And Solomon was the wisest man that ever was or will be, but he's still not comparable to God. You're right. But that being said, is he still not the most qualified man to perform this task? Versus other men, I think he's still it. And of course, you know, God, of course, is going to know the answer, and he's going to be better qualified, but he's God. I couldn't think of anything that would limit him. And so he comes to his conclusion, or actually I did this bit a little out of, I spun it around, because he discusses some things, but in verse 13, he sought to seek out the answer. He sought it diligently. And all that was done under the sun, through wisdom. This burdensome task that God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. In verse 14, he comes to the conclusion, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. The same thing he stated in verse 2. That's it. It's all vanity, it's all futile, it's all fleeting, there's no profit, no advantage. Why does he come to that conclusion in this point? And based on verse 15. And also you see the same thing in chapter 7, verse 13.
God put in motion certain things like cycles that man cannot fix. We're all going to die. We're all born, we die. We have kids, they die, they have kids. So it's a constant cycle that we cannot fix no longer how we try. We may be able to live longer through health care, but we're still going to die.
Yeah, we can't change the fact that we die. I mean, what else does he say? Maybe even though we die, maybe we could find something that would give us profit within that time frame. But what does he say prevents that? In verse 15. Sorry? Yeah, nothing can be changed. He says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. You know, if it's crooked, it's crooked. You can't change it. We see in chapter in chapter 7, verse 13, sort of also kind of you were hitting on it, David. Verse 13: Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what He has made crooked? You know what God has set into motion, what God has made. It can't be we can't undo it. There's no changing what God has done. And also we see in the end of 15, it says, what is lacking cannot be numbered. There's you know, so much that's lax that we can't amend, we can't fix that. You know, can wisdom, you know, all his wisdom, could he fix these things? He couldn't make what was crooked straight. And he can't provide for everyone in the world what is lacking. There's, you know, the wisdom cannot achieve the profitability he was looking for. Wisdom itself is not the answer. There's no profit in wisdom. And he comes to that conclusion. He shows that in verse 18. For much wisdom is much grief. Or actually, in verse 17. I marked that. 17 through 18. And I set my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. So he looked at both sides. He looked at wisdom. He wanted to understand it. And he looked also at folly and madness, the opposite, to understand it. So he is doing that. Different point of views. He's looking for different point of views and really understanding it. And he says, I perceive that this is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Why do we think wisdom increases grief and sorrow?
Ignorance is bliss. That's the first thing that came to my mind when I read that, because the more you know, the more it's going to hurt.
Yeah, so you're saying the more you know, the more... I guess the more it hurts,
because you can't change anything.
I was listening to several. Actually, this is a question I actually answered on the sheet. I put down different possibilities, and kind of they're all kind of they're. I guess it depends how you look at each one. They could be very clearly different, but sometimes when I look at them, they kind of intermingle. So it depends on your point of view. Depends on how you translate what he's saying. You know, it could be that. You know, more wisdom seals the futility of earthly endeavors. The more you know, the more you know it to be true. It's all vanity. And so that same, you know, he brings you the same unsatisfactory answer. Give me a couple of minutes, not less than that, to finish this up. And to I looked at it this way, to increase knowledge reveals more unknowns. I think you sort of said that. The more remains concealed. The more you know, the more you realize you don't know it all. And so you're never going to get to the conclusion of it. You know, only God knows it all, and only He knows the answer. And also, Ms. Hudson pointed out that, you learn that you can't change anything. You know, no matter how much you know, more wisdom you get, you're still impotent to exact any changes. And so those kind of blend together, but you know, we don't get that what is profitable under the sun. We don't get the answer except for that nothing is.
The more you know, the less you know.
Yeah.
Well, this reminds me of that poem, God give me the ability to change the things I can and accept the things I can't and help me know the difference.
Yes.
Things that I can't change, things that I can't change.
Very good thing.